Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual ration of two guests today. First, in moments, Priyamvada Gopal will analyze the reality behind the West's celebration of its unique notions of freedom after the Paris massacres. And then at the bottom of the hour, Maya Shenhar will talk about American practices of extreme unfreedom, imprisonment. A few words about the Paris bloodletting first. I must say that I was very distressed by how many people on the left flirted with making excuses for that horror. I read and heard a lot of people who sort of said that the Charlie Hebdo editors didn't deserve to die for what they did, but they were odious and hateful, and then they uttered a barely audible but and trailed off. The evidence for their being odious and hateful was some very quick readings of some complex cartoons. People who know French and French culture well laid forth readings of those cartoons that show that they were satiric, not hateful. They were attacking bigots, not the weak, by caricaturing the images and words proffered by those bigots. The editor of the magazine killed in the attack was known as one of the strongest supporters of the Palestinian cause in France. The magazine ran cartoons viciously portraying Israel's most recent attack on Gaza. The magazine has been sued by Marine Le Pen, leader of the crypto-fascist and xenophobic National Front, because of its repeated attacks. These facts didn't stop a lot of commenters from signing off about how the cartoons were self-evidently racist, as if a complex text always means what a naive reader concludes on its first impression. There was also a tendency to treat the French Muslim population as an undifferentiated mass, of which armed lunatics are a fair representation. There's no doubt that Muslims in France are a discriminated against population, but it's a far more diverse group than most Anglophones seem to think. My friend Seth Ackerman, who reads French and knows the political scene well, wrote this in a piece for Jacobin Magazine, which you can find at their website, jacobinmag.com. Quote, at the time of the original controversy over the Muhammad caricatures in 2006, a French survey asked respondents whether they understood the outrage among some Muslims. Not even half of French Muslims, 48%, said they completely understood the outrage. 24% said they didn't understand at all, not that much different from French Catholics. When the so-called headscarf law was proposed in 2004, 20% of French Muslims were completely in favor. Again, not all that different from the French population as a whole. Only 31% of Muslims were completely opposed. When demonstrations against the law were organized, French Muslims' views and the protests were all over the map. This should not be surprising, because most French of Muslim background are not all that religious. 75% generally do not go to mosque on Friday, and 84% of Muslim women never wear a headscarf. Only 41% call themselves practicing Muslims, and 26% decline to call themselves believers at all. Once again, about the same as for French Catholics. That does not mean, I'm still quoting Seth Ackerman, that French Muslims are indistinguishable from the general population. Two-thirds abstain from alcohol and non-halal food, for example. But it does mean that being Muslim in France does not automatically mean one agrees with the strident fundamentalists who tearfully insist that a bunch of obnoxious cartoons in an anti-religious magazine are an unbearable insult to every Muslim. The greatest danger now, as the alarming spate of violent anti-Muslim attacks shows, is that French Muslims will be further essentialized by their enemies on the right, who would like nothing more than to equate Arab with Muslim, Muslim with fundamentalist, and fundamentalist with terrorist. But it's equally important that Muslims not be essentialized by their friends either. And that's the end of my long quote from Seth Ackerman. But it's revolting to see the West now proclaiming its deep belief in freedom of expression, even as its police are running a crackdown and xenophobes are on the march. Here to parse those contradictions for us is Priyamvada Gopal, who teaches at Cambridge University. She has an essay on liberal imperialism in the Oxford Handbook of Postcolonial Studies that analyzes the liberal warriors in the wake of 9/11. We're now seeing a revival of those same instincts. Here's Priyamvada Gopal. A lot of people noted a parallel between a Je suis Charlie thing, the famous headline of Le Monde after 9/11, we're all Americans. And it seems, reading your essay, that we almost reliving the period immediately in the wake of September 11th with a mixture of very loud dedication to liberal values on one hand, combined with the forces of repression on the other. This is not an accidental combination, is it?
No, it's not. I think that what we saw in the immediate wake of September 11, 2001, was on the one hand a sort of deification of the West as both victimized and then resurgent, a deification of the West as the sole guarantor of freedom, a nebulous idea as it was articulated then, followed by both a very, very strong militaristic project and domestic repression, including, of course, surveillance and widespread, you know, arrests and detention for suspected involvement in terrorism. So I think that that combination of the deification of liberty followed by repression is something we're seeing again in the wakes of the, you know, the terrible attack in Paris.
The wars after 9/11, one associates with the right, with George Bush and conservative Republicans. Yet there was certainly a cheering section on the liberal left, right? That was a very important part of the whole apparatus.
Yes. I mean, actually, for me, one of the more striking aspects of the last, decade and a half or so has been the extent to which we have had, what has come to be known as the liberal hawk, the, you know, liberal voices arguing for the American imperial project, in a sense, for arguing the case for America as a guarantor of freedom, and making the case for liberal values and values such as tolerance and liberty as specifically Western. And while they're in need of being universalized, suggesting that they originate in the West. And I think that that's a very tenacious idea. It crosses political lines. It isn't restricted to conservatives, but is widely propounded by, you know, sections of liberals and the liberal left in both the U.S. and in Europe.
So this contradiction, this on the one hand loudly bragging about freedom of speech and expression, and on the other hand practicing very much unfreedom, repression and violence, is this mere hypocrisy, or is there something more structurally related about it? Do they constitute each other somehow, two sides of the same coin? What is the relation exactly?
It is, I think, if you like, a constitutive hypocrisy. I think the problem with simply calling it a hypocrisy and pointing to the many instances, as one can, of France, stepping on people's freedom of expression, banning rallies, banning the hijab, and so on. If you just call it hypocrisy, then it just turns it into a simple kind of moral issue, which can be, you know, relatively easily corrected. And it seems to me that it is actually a structural issue. And one of the things that we have to be attentive to whenever, you know, freedom becomes the ostensible point of contention is just how much authoritarianism goes into the making of so-called freedom, tendentiously used in neoliberal contexts. And it seems to me, two examples really I can give you here. Two major Western allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, very, very different on the political spectrum, very different on in terms of religious constitution. Both have very, very bad records in terms of freedom of speech, in terms of, you know, attacking journalists, in terms of, journalists who have died, for instance, in the Gaza invasion last summer. Saudi Arabia, of course, is currently has currently subjected a young blogger, Rauf Badawi, to 1,000 lashes, which will be meted out on him over the course of the year. These are both very visible contexts where you have authoritarianism and repression of freedom of speech, but actually the West has nothing to say about either, and takes a hands-off line. Now, this is, in a sense, structural. It is constitutive. You know, it is about people who are allies in the larger neoliberal project and therefore do not need to be, they don't need to be punished on the altar of freedom and free speech. But then others are selectively brought into the frame. So it does seem to me that the liberal project of neutralizing dissent requires both coercion and consent. And in that sense, this is structural rather than merely moral.
What have you been seeing in Britain in the wake of the Paris attacks?
We've been seeing a very familiar discourse in the media. It is, calling for what commentators here like to call muscular liberalism, hard-headed liberalism, enlightenment values. And there's been a call once again for these values to be made dominant, to force immigrants and ethnic minorities to assimilate them or to leave. And there has been, once again, a very tenacious assertion of the idea that tolerance and liberty are, British values in the first instance and Western values more broadly, and that, people either need to assimilate and follow them or leave. It's quite a crude discourse in its own right, but it's been striking how resurgent it has been in the last couple of weeks, but also very predictable because this is exactly what happened a decade and a half ago.
And I presume the Labour Party people and that's the milieu of the left is little different from what you hear on the right, or is it?
Not especially. I mean, I think with the right in Britain, you have a much more explicit rejection of what they like to sneer at as, human rights. And we have the Tory party, which is, currently in coalition, explicitly saying that, sections of the populace, including prisoners, terror suspects, and so on, should not have human rights, and that and complaining very explicitly about the human rights regime that has been forced upon them by the EU. And in that sense, it's a more direct, honest engagement with human rights. The left has taken the position I've described before, that to be British is to be liberal, to be British is to be tolerant, and it is minorities who need to be assimilating to these values. And that, there's been very little dissent really around the idea that free speech and liberty are Western values, and that they need to be adhered to or else.
And yes, they must be enforced by the police.
Precisely, and also, of course, both in France and in Britain in the last couple of years, we have seen, a very heavy crackdown on certain forms of speech, which are referred to as inciting, racial or religious hatred. And also we've seen, and this is something I don't see very many people talking about, we've seen a crackdown on protest. France has, of course, recently banned any pro-Palestinian demonstrations. And in other words, you cannot participate in a rally or a demonstration that for the cause of Palestine. In Britain, of course, student activism has been cracked down on heavily. Students were, punished and jailed for, fairly minor offenses when they were very active a few years ago. And there is increasingly legislation that makes protest very, very costly.
Parenthetically, Francophobia is never far from the surface in British or American culture. Do you see any signs of that, or is that on temporary hiatus?
It seems to be on temporary hiatus. I think what is also very noticeable is the way in which, what in France is being seen as a sort of French values, French post-revolutionary values, has been very seamlessly adopted into the discourse of Western values. And so in a sense, you also see the kind of reassertion of the idea of the West as some kind of seamless, homogenous entity which shares values, and which therefore, because it shares values, also shares a global political program. So in a sense, again, there is a kind of very deliberate use of a specific incident in a specific cultural context, cultural and political context, to open it out and to make it universal in a rather false way.
I'm speaking with Priyamvada Gopal, who teaches at Cambridge University. And that division that you spoke of earlier, in which the West is seen as the land of freedom and the non-West seen as the land of unfreedom, I think there's some people who see the immigration from non-Western areas as an import of that notion of unfreedom and something that must be protected.
Are you saying that immigration should be protected?
No. It's immigration. Immigrants are bringing with them their culture of unfreedom, and freedom has to be defended against this dangerous import.
Oh, yes, yes. It's what in Britain is referred to as creeping Sharia. You know, the idea that tyranny and despotism are alien to the West and they're being brought by immigrants. So, for instance, I'll give you an example. Yesterday, it turns out that the Sun newspaper, which is one of the most popular tabloids here, has finally pulled its page 3 topless models. You know, it's not policy that's been announced, but the issues of the paper this week have not had page 3. And online, there's been a sort of furious Twitter storm arguing that this is actually the result of creeping Sharia law, and that it's Muslims with their puritanical attitudes towards the body and covering up the body who have forced Murdoch's newspaper to finally pull page 3, where in fact there's of course been a very sustained feminist campaign to stop page 3. So absolutely, there is very much this idea that anything that impinges on certain quite selective understandings of, you know, what one must be free to do are being put upon and what is the word I'm looking for? That as you suggested, that a sort of foreign element is bringing despotism into Britain and into the EU more broadly.
And that crude division between us as the realm of freedom and them as the realm of unfreedom does at least two bad things. One is it denies the repression on this side and also denies the degree of dissent and diversity on the other.
Yeah, precisely. It does both. And the real tragedy here is that although, you know, these are, you know, values such as tolerance, liberty, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of action and protest, are, you know, touted as universal values, in fact, the ways in which they're articulated are anything but universal. So the idea is that these are Western values, which must then be adopted by more backward cultures. And this is a very familiar idea to us from, you know, from Victorian imperial times. And so what it does is that it, in fact, what ought to be universal and what is in fact universal there is actually turned into something that is parochial and Western. And actually ends up creating a resistance to, you know, ideas of tolerance and personal freedom and, you know, social freedom, where there might not have been resistance to it, because it becomes then a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the resistance to the West then does involve sometimes, you know, a degree of valorizing despotism, valorizing social unfreedom. So it's a kind of a vicious cycle that is really dangerous in more than one way.
How is your country of origin, India, seen in the former colonial homeland of Britain? How does India fall into this model?
What struck me is that in the last year, we've seen a lot of unfreedom in India. We have seen quite heavy attacks on internet freedom. We have seen, you know, journalists getting into trouble. We've seen young people who have, you know, made Facebook posts critical of the current prime minister and the current government taken into custody. There is next to no discussion of this, certainly in Britain. The assumption is, and in fact, well, it's not an assumption, it's really a fiction, that India was bestowed parliamentary democracy by Britain. India was the best pupil of parliamentary democracy. India embraced parliamentary democracy, and therefore all is well. And of course, the reason that this narrative is so widely embraced is that India has embraced not just parliamentary democracy, but neoliberalism. And as long as, you know, that country continues to embrace the very selective Western idea of freedom as neoliberalism, there is very, you know, unlikely to be any sort of querying of what's been going on there. We know President Obama is spending Republic Day this coming weekend in India as on a state visit as the guest of honor. And I see very little, you know, attention being paid to whether, you know, whether it's infringement of freedom of speech or the much more or even more serious attacks on human rights and freedom in places like Kashmir. They're just not really part of the global discussion.
It's amazing that the Prime Minister of India emerges out of a fascist party, and yet he is really celebrated in the West because he embraces the most important freedoms of all, free trade and the free movement of capital.
Yeah, and it is exactly that simple. You know, the question that also does need to be asked, I think, at this conjuncture is, what is freedom? And really, what is it that we ought to be free to do? And there's very little discussion of how tendentious the so-called, you know, Western or European idea of freedom is. It is pretty much reduced to freedom to consume and freedom to trade for large companies. And it isn't about, freedom of people to move. It isn't about freedom of labor. It isn't about, and there isn't also any emphasis on the right to be free from hunger or free from deprivation or free from tyranny. It really is all about what one is free to do as an individual. And that's very tied up with capitalism and with neoliberalism. And there's, I think, next to no discussion of what the content of freedom is. So that precisely, you can come from a deeply authoritarian formation and you can come from a sort of fascist background, but as long as you sing from the neoliberal hymn sheet, you are considered a votary of freedom.
And have the British anti-immigration forces like UKIP embraced the Paris massacre as political gold from their point of view?
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it didn't take any time at all for that to be assimilated very smoothly into the discourse, again, of creeping Sharia, of creeping Islamicization, of the problem with people being inadequately British or not respecting British values. And, you know, what's less interesting is UKIP's reaction than is the fact that all the mainstream parties, Labour, the Liberal Democrats, and of course the Conservatives now have to follow UKIP's lead in starting to then moan about how Britishness is also under attack and how immigration must be tied up to this kind of, again, very nebulous idea of Britishness.
Yeah, and the embrace by the mainstream of these characters is amazing because Marine Le Pen had an op-ed in the New York Times the other day. She was also interviewed by the Wall Street Journal, she was treated as a reasonable person.
Yes.
One of the sinister ways in which these quasi-fascist parties work their influence is through the movement to the mainstream in their direction.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think this is the story of our decade, of the present decade, is the mainstreaming of forces that are, that any other time would have been seen as extremist and beyond the pale. But at the same time, this is accompanied by denigrating as extremist other sorts of worldviews and other sorts of understandings of history. So it's also very interesting to see who is now mainstream and who or what is now extremist. And anything that really, again, challenges the idea that, the West is the locus of freedom and that freedom is tied up to the freedom to trade is then therefore an extremist. And if you go along with the neoliberal mantra, then you are mainstream.
That was Priyam Vadagopal, who teaches at Cambridge University. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwin, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Mine.
That was some of Declaration of Freedom by Laibach. Next up is Maya Shenwar, editor-in-chief of Truthout. She has a piece on the Truthout website on house arrest, monitoring, and offended funder justice. And her book, Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better, was published by Barrett Kohler in November. Maya Shenwar. Welcome. Let's start by talking first about Marissa Alexander, who, I mean, there's so much in her story, the racism and sexism of the criminal justice system, the preposterously long sentence, and now the false promise of release. So let's talk first about just, you know, for people who might not remember the case, what's her story and what's been happening to her over the last several years?
Well, Marissa Alexander was a survivor of domestic violence and kind of a serially abusive husband who was endangering her and her children. And when she had just recently given birth to a premature baby, her estranged husband came back and was threatening her, and she was under kind of a direct, imminent physical attack. And what she ended up doing was going to her garage and firing a warning shot against her husband. So directly firing away from him. This was meant to be kind of a way of defending herself without harming anyone. Now, of course, the way our criminal justice system works, specifically toward Black women, but often domestic violence survivors get caught in it kind of in an opposite way than you would expect. So when the police got involved in this situation, Marissa Alexander was taken to be the perpetrator of a crime as opposed to being a victim. And she's been in and out of all kinds of situations over the past now more than 4 years. And at one point, she was actually facing a 60-year prison sentence. That's what the prosecutor was looking for.
And we should say that this is in Florida, the home of George Zimmerman.
Oh, yes. Right. Exactly. In fact, it was such a strange case because Marissa's attorneys actually tried to argue a stand-your-ground defense after Zimmerman was successful on those grounds, and she failed. So Marissa was not seen to be standing her ground when she fired that warning shot that harmed no one. And so she was facing this 60-year sentence, and her trial was coming up. And ultimately, she decided to sign a plea deal because she was worried that she would be taken away for 60 years and miss the rest of her life. And so when she signed that plea deal, people got very excited because it looked like she'd basically be spending a little over 60 days in jail as opposed to spending 60 years in prison. And along those lines, I think, you know, it was good news, but what was left out of the news in most of the articles was the fact that she would be spending 2 years on house arrest after being released from jail. A lot of people think about house arrest as if it's just being at home more than usual. And it kind of almost seems like a comfortable situation. And really, in some ways, it's more restrictive than a prison sentence. And so I think when we look at Marissa's sentence and what she ended up with, we have to keep that in mind. We can't see house arrest as a blessing. We have to see it as a different kind of imprisonment.
So what are the conditions of her house arrest going to be? She has to wear a bracelet, right?
Yeah, she has to wear an electronic monitor. And when she wants movement, when she wants to leave the house, she has to request that permission. She will be able to go to work, for example. There are a couple of exceptions that are built in for Marissa specifically. Of course, you know, if she can find a job, that's always a really big if for someone coming out of prison or out of jail.
Well, also the very sight of the monitor will scare away employers too, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that the sight of the monitor for a lot of not only employers, but when you're looking for housing, even when you're making friends, that monitor is just like this glaring felon label, even without a background check or anything of that sort.
And so this goes on for 2 years, and then what kind of, does she get visits and drug tests, or what kind of conditions besides the confinement to the house with the ankle bracelet?
Well, I'm not sure actually what the deal is for Marissa specifically with drug tests. It's kind of funny with the system, the way that drug tests play out. Plenty of people are subjected to regular drugs, if drugs have nothing to do with their crime. So that's highly possible. The main thing for her is that she'll be wearing the monitor and confined to her house most of the time. And she'll also have to be dealing with the way the criminal justice system interacts with child protective services. That's kind of a big if in her situation, because one of the things that was being argued was that she was endangering her children. And in a case like Marissa's, when she was actually trying to defend her children, it looks kind of ludicrous, at least from my perspective, but she's in a precarious place in relation to child protective services, because her children were effectively taken away from her. I think she's able to live with two of them now because she's able to live with family members, but one of them actually is currently with her estranged ex-husband. So because he's determined to be a safe party to take care of the child, and Marissa is determined to be a danger.
Yes, that sounds like the wisdom of the criminal justice system. And then she's going to have to pick up the tab for a lot of this monitoring, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's another kind of fun feature of electronic monitoring, increasingly in a number of states, but Florida is just kind of like the flagship when it comes to this type of thing. So she's going to have to pay $105 per week for her electronic monitor. So she's paying kind of for the privilege of her own confinement. It's a very weird system. And that system has been sold to the public as, well, you know, we're not spending any public money on this. It's something that people have to pay for themselves because they did something wrong. It's a really kind of a twisted logic.
This gives new meaning to paying your debt to society, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this is called offender-funded justice in some circles, right? Now, this is also a feature of a lot of probation these days, right?
Right, right. It's not just electronic monitoring. An increasing number of states are doing this thing where people on probation have to pay for those, quote, services. So I think the strangest thing to me is that not only are people paying for these services, I don't want to say services, but those are the words that are used, they're actually paying for probation on penalty of future imprisonment. So if they can't pay their fees, they're actually at risk of going back to prison for that non-payment. So it's really a form of debtor's prison.
Now, most people who have encounters with the criminal justice system are not affluent. So I imagine most offenders, it's not easy for them, especially, you know, given the complications of finding employment when you've had a run-in with the criminal justice system. It's not easy to come up with the money to pay your all these fees, is it?
Right, exactly. And so it's not easy to find a job when you've just gotten out, of course. And since most people coming out of the system are very poor, it's not like their families can just front the bill. Many times they're dealing with just the burden of having someone come out of the system. They oftentimes have to put them up, have to provide housing for them, have to pay for their needs. And so on top of that, to have to pay for their probation is just, it's such a bizarre turn of the system. And it really, I think, speaks to just a continued, a new form of oppression for people who are poor and low income.
Okay, let's turn some to your book and the prison itself. I mean, we're seeing the prison, the structure or the psychology of prison extending outside the prison walls, but then we also have lots of people in old-fashioned prisons as well. Your book, one of the things I like about it is the way you write about its impact on the families of people who are incarcerated, which is something that people don't necessarily think about as much as they should. Your sister, you write a lot about your sister and her experience with the criminal justice system. So could you review a bit of that history?
Yeah, absolutely. So almost 10 years ago, actually shortly after I had started reporting on the criminal legal system as a journalist, my sister was incarcerated. And since then, she's been in and out of jail and prison. And so my work on the book is kind of different from my other journalistic work in that I kind of tied together that personal experience of my sister being incarcerated and my family dealing with kind of the implications of that, both bad and sort of temporarily good, and how that ties in with kind of the larger picture of incarceration. Because, yeah, a lot of times we talk again and again about these numbers, 2.4 million people in the United States are incarcerated, but we're not thinking about the millions and millions and millions of other people who are affected by that incarceration.
I'm speaking with Maya Shenwar, who is the editor-in-chief of Truthout and author of Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. You describe these visits to the Cook County Jail, where she was held for a while. It just sounds like screaming through plexiglass as a way to have a visit.
Yeah. The way that you visit someone in Cook County Jail is you come into the jail and you're kind of treated like a prisoner yourself. You're herded through these long lines and yelled at and patted down. And then you get into the visiting room. And what it is it's just this crowded mass of people. There are some stools set up that no one sits on. And you're across this plexiglass window from a number of people in Cook County Jail, prisoners who are trying to shout at you through holes in the wall. That's how you're expected to talk to your loved ones. And it's, I think, compounded by the fact that it's really difficult to communicate in any other way. You can write letters. That's kind of the most dependable form of communication, is snail mail, you know, writing letters. And the other thing is the phone, which is this weird system where you can't call prison from the outside, you can't call jail, so you have to wait until the person that you want to communicate with has an opportunity to call you, which could be at any time. It's completely unpredictable. The phone rates are exorbitant, and then when they actually get the chance to call, you might not be there to pick up the phone because you don't know when it's coming. So these visits, there's all this weight on them, this weight of feeling like, okay, finally I have a chance to see this person's face and talk to them. And you get there and it's almost hard to say anything above the noise and kind of above all these pent-up emotions. It's a very, very weird process. And of course you have guards staring down at you at every second.
And yet the phone calls are also like interrupted with a voice reminding you you're speaking to a prisoner.
Right, exactly. Yeah, every few minutes you have someone coming in to tell you that you are speaking with an inmate of whatever the institution is. And then the phone calls are cut off kind of at either because they've decided something's gone wrong with the system, or sometimes they're cut off for no reason. But even if they're cut off at the normal time, they'll say, okay, you have a minute to wrap up your conversation. And then you start crying or try to say goodbye or finish your sentence. And it just cuts off the line. It's a strange form of communication.
And all this for $1 a minute or so.
Right.
Again, you know, people who are the relatives of prisoners are very unlikely to be able to afford dollar a minute calls for very long.
Right. I think sometimes we look at this from the outside and, you know, the fact of exorbitant prison phone rates, sometimes for people, it effectively means that they can't talk to their loved ones because so many people are operating at such a low income that really, if you're looking at an $11 phone call, that might mean that you talk twice a month, you know. And actually, I've had a number of people that I've corresponded with that their families just couldn't call them. Sometimes their phone service was actually cut off because they were trying to spend so much money in just keeping in regular contact.
You have some heartbreaking descriptions of the loss of contact that occurs over long prison sentences. After 5 or 10 years, people's families and friends forget all about them, right?
Right. They often just fall away. And it's funny, when my sister was incarcerated, and she's always been incarcerated for short periods of time, even though it's happened over a longer period of time, I've noticed that I'll start writing my sister fewer and fewer letters just because, and there are a lot of reasons behind it, but because all of these forms of communication are so stunted, and that's compounded by the fact that you really have less and less to talk about because the person in prison, often they're just doing the same thing every single day, and they often feel like they don't have much to share in the form of a letter. And so these bonds inevitably break down. And a lot of the people that I correspond with in prison who've been there over a long period of time, they've fallen out of contact with almost everyone. Some cases with everyone. I know a prisoner, someone in solitary confinement, who hasn't had a phone call in 20 years because there's just no one at the other end of the line.
Oh, God, that's just... it's just heartbreaking to think of this. But we, you know, we're consigning, you know, people, millions of people, these incredibly, ridiculously long sentences. But you also describe some emotional complexities of feeling a sense of relief on occasion when your sister got arrested. What's that about?
Well, my sister in particular, and I think this is the case for a number of people in prison, my sister had a serious heroin dependency. And so that addiction was actually putting her in harm's way, especially since we live in this society where you can't openly have a heroin addiction. You can't say, I'm a heroin addict and I'd like to go for regular medical care and be open about my addiction and get the care I need. You have to kind of live in the shadows in a certain way and carry out your life in a way that you're putting yourself in danger. So at the time of my sister's arrest that I discuss in the book, she was homeless. She was living on the street. And she was taking heroin in ways that were conducive to an overdose, basically. She wasn't seeking medical care. She didn't know anything about the drugs that she was getting. It was a situation in which often I was getting calls from her in the hospital when she was on the verge of death. Someone had found her in the middle of the street. So this is kind of the lifestyle that we push people into when they have these addictions. So frankly, as I write in the book, I was relieved sometimes when she was arrested because it meant that A, she was alive, and B, she would be in a place where she was less likely to be using large overdosable amounts of heroin. Now, that was a very naive assumption in some ways for me. I mean, even disregarding the fact that I was a prison abolitionist and not thinking that people should be put in prison to supposedly solve their problems. But even just in the short run, there was actually heroin available at Cook County Jail. So even that kind of like immediate sense of relief was naive. But it was definitely a palpable thing that I felt, that wow, a huge sense of relief that she was being taken into custody. So it's kind of, I mean, it's a lose-lose situation that's being set up for us in relation to drug addiction.
Well, because there's so few humane alternatives for people with drug problems, unless you're like an investment banker with a cocaine habit and could afford an expensive rehab.
Right, right. Yeah, if you're in that position and you can afford that like extremely expensive treatment and you can also afford to kind of like be a little bit open about your habit without feeling like you're putting yourself at risk of going to jail, then I think that yeah, you do have that opportunity, but most of us don't. And I think about some of the systems that are being tried in other countries. I know here we're moving toward marijuana legalization, and that's really good. But in other countries, even when it comes to things like cocaine and heroin, there are systems that are being tried that are not just like, okay, we arrest people and put them in treatment instead of jail. They're really looking outside of that illegal model to begin with. They're doing things like offering medically administered heroin on the streets, small doses that will kind of make sure that people are kept in a healthy range, a relatively healthy range, and not constantly being at risk for death. That's something that's being tried in Vancouver and in the UK. And like, I think that's something that seems really practical, that, okay, well, if this is medically administered, not only are we helping people avoid overdose, we're also helping people avoid HIV and other transmittable diseases. That's good for everyone to have a healthier society. It's a logical move, but it's not one that I anticipate happening here anytime soon.
And finally, since we're running low on time, you also write in the book about alternatives to incarceration, not house arrest, but serious alternatives to incarceration. Could you talk about those?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the first alternative to keep in mind is that so many people are arrested for crimes that don't actually hurt anyone. And so the alternative is to reevaluate our definition of crime and actually not incarcerate most of the people that we're incarcerating. Like, they don't need to be arrested in the first place. In terms of situations where we're actually dealing with harm or violence, I think that if we're thinking outside of arresting and incarcerating people, we need to actually think about the people who are being harmed and what they need, what would actually be helpful for their healing and for preventing this kind of violence in the future. And so there are a bunch of different systems kind of based around that idea of actually looking at the violence that's happening instead of just looking at laws and, you know, kind of the perpetrator versus the state. And one thing that I talk about is restorative justice, which is kind of involving the victim and the perpetrator and the community, usually in a sort of circle or conference, talking about what are options that we can look to in terms of holding the offender accountable and helping the victim heal. And oftentimes, the accountability agreements that are drawn up in those types of situations require a lot more out of the person who did harm than jail does. They often require the person to really change their lives, to get on a completely different track, in addition to doing things, maybe making reparations to the specific victim. They require the person to sometimes pursue intensive counseling, pursue an education, earn money in a certain way to pay the victim a reparation fee. And that requires a transformation that hopefully will prevent harm in the future. And that, I think, should be the goal. So that's just one example of an alternative.
Yeah, I live in Brooklyn, and I've had a computer and a car stolen. And I must admit that I wanted the perp to be breaking rocks, but that's not really a very constructive reaction, right?
I had my computer stolen actually while I was writing this book.
Yes, that, and you managed to, did you have to rewrite everything?
I had to rewrite quite a bit, but the way I rewrote it, I think it actually turned out better because I needed to write it with kind of more humility, given that when my computer was stolen, I actually ended up getting the police involved, and nothing good came of it, but that did happen.
Yeah, well, if you want to collect the insurance, you have to get the police involved, which is a problem. I'd rather not, you know. That was Maya Shenwar, editor-in-chief of Truth Out and author of Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better, which was published last November by Barrett Kohler. There's a lot more in the book about alternatives to incarceration, so if you're interested, pick up a copy. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another bout of gloomy music, some of Eden Prison by Swans from a live WFMU broadcast in 2011. Till next week, bye. Over there in the walls of Eden Prison, there is a mark upon a stone, and in this place life was written.